drawings to share with you. Maybe some of them are familiar to you with Kevin's help here. These were done by Ernst Haeckel, a great naturalist, biologist, and artist who drew these absolutely intricate, scientifically accurate, and just frankly gorgeous drawings of many, many creatures. Jellyfish, shall we see the next one? And shelled creatures, I know. I wanted to do honor to how he drew them, so I'm putting them in portrait, even though that makes them a little smaller. Just gorgeous. And will you give us the next one? Most famously, diatoms. He was this German naturalist, biologist, who not only discovered and drew many, many protists, but gave them the name, protista. That did not exist until he created that category. Haeckel also gave us the word ecology. Thanks, Haeckel. And he was a scientific racist. You know, the whole quote-unquote science of race. How do we account for the fact that people look different, have different kinds of features in different places around the world? Well, Haeckel was advocate of the theory that we look different because we came from different strains. Now, okay, any biologist can make a mistake. And we now know that the current biological understanding is people, however they look, all came from the same place, the Rift Valley, around the same time, and spread out around the world from there. That's not the problem, that he was incorrect about that. The problem is that he frankly believed that the science proved, well, what he already thought, that some races were simply inferior, closer to the animal, less human, resulting in deserving fewer rights. All that beauty he made, and then this ugly, ugly teaching. He was a eugenicist as well. He didn't just talk about how certain people were inferior. He recommended purging them from the human lineage by putting mentally challenged and congenitally ill people to death. A generation later, the Third Reich in his country acted on these recommendations. How are we to hold this contradiction, if it is a contradiction? Such beauty, knowledge, wisdom even, and such ugliness from the same source. This comes up all the time in conversations around what is called cancel culture. So I want to say that some topics of the many that we're not taking up today, that I just don't have time to get into, and that frankly I don't find as important, are whether to honor people whose accomplishments were great despite their failings, you know, naming schools and roads and so on after them, whether to use the works of somebody like Haeckel, whether to boycott people who are still producing things and might actually earn money off the things that we purchase from them, even though we have major problems with some of their message. I don't mean to say these are unimportant conversations. They absolutely are. But I want to talk about something that I think is even more fundamental. So you probably have people popping into your head right now, and I won't even be naming all the ones that you're thinking of. J.K. Rowling, Theodore Roosevelt, Thomas Jefferson, Harvey Weinstein. Am I the only person who shudders every time I am watching a movie and suddenly the Miramax logo comes on? Oh, that's how that movie was made. I'm sure I'm not. Margaret Sanger. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about her. Because Haeckel, he was a eugenicist, but Margaret Sanger, I think, comes a little closer to home. She was an advocate of birth control for women at a time that that was illegal. It was illegal for anybody of any marital status or gender to get a hold of ways to prevent giving birth. And this was tremendously liberating. We have her to thank for huge developments in our social structure as well as in medicine. She wasn't a doctor, but the fact that that she said, you know, this is absolutely necessary for people to be healthy, for people to be happy in their lives, gave rise to a whole field of medicine. And she was a eugenicist. She wanted to prevent the births of people whom she saw as not less interested in having children for themselves, but less worthy in her eyes. And bless her for this, she founded Planned Parenthood. What are we to do with this mixed legacy? Why we even see it as a problem, I think, is a feature of the cognitive bias known as the halo effect. The halo effect is if you think somebody's really good at, you know somebody's very good at something, you then take their take them as expert in some other field. Michael Jordan is a fabulous basketball player, and therefore you might actually follow his medical advice if he gets on a commercial. All right, we laugh, but right, this is what celebrity endorsements are all about. He knows shoes. That's not a bad endorsement. Okay, you might actually want these sneakers, although you also might want to keep in your mind that he's getting it paid a lot to recommend those particular sneakers. But you know, he's not expert at anything else necessarily, and we do that all the time. And so we want to believe that because Margaret Sanger was such a marvelous leader, a moral leader, in saying women are dying because their doctors are telling them, not one more pregnancy, it will kill you, and they're saying, what am I supposed to do? I can't say no to my husband forever. And sex, sooner or later, meant another pregnancy and the destruction that would follow. She did tremendous good. And the halo effect makes us want to believe that, therefore, she's good at anything or a good person in any realm. It's just not true. So I see lots and lots of problems, but I want to talk specifically about three problems with this difficulty we have in separating out, in dealing with the fact that there simply are contradictions within people, such as the ones I've listed and some of the ones in your head right now. People, it seems, I don't know, everybody but Mr. Rogers, Dolly Parton, and Lin-Manuel Miranda. And don't even tell me, they probably have failings too. Actually, never mind. The problem, three problems with believing that people have to be all sinner or saint. First is that we will deny ourselves things of beauty and wisdom because we tell ourselves, surely they can't really be beautiful and wise if their creators do something so wrong. Like, we feel a little uncomfortable maybe now using the works of Ernst Haeckel or enjoying them. And it's one thing to feel that way, to notice that uncomfortable tension, but quite another to actually let them drop out of our lives. Because you can do it with this and that, but you can't do it with everybody. Here's a comical example. Traveling in the circles that I do, I see a lot of people online who, until a few years ago, would share things like, tell us about your personality. What Hogwarts house are you? You know, it's fun, right? And people get serious. I think my father's a Hufflepuff, my mother's a Ravenclaw. What does that make me? Some of these same people have now passed around posts highly critical of this idea. What house are you? I don't sort out my personality based on the problematic works written for children. You know, it's okay to think that Rowling is a problem. She is. If, in case you missed it, she's now quite a prominent and stubborn spreader of transphobic myths. It was more fun when she was a mensch to be a Harry Potter fan, because she was a really wonderful person, and she still is in many ways, but not on that point. So it's fine to say, I've got a problem with her. It's fine even to say, you know what, I'm not going to play that game because it's really hurtful just to even see her name in my feed for some people who are really dear to me. You know, that's a valid argument. What's not valid is to say all of a sudden that everything that she created is not of worth that you used to think was. Like, how did that happen? I think it happened only because we have that little process in our head that says, well, if she does this bad thing, then I can't think that she created something fun and lovable anymore. So it's kind of comical when it comes to Hogwarts houses, but it's not so comical multiplied out times all the Rowlings out there. Another example. I brought up Teddy Roosevelt because, you know, he was a progressive leader who did the title of Republican honor. I mean, I could go on about his many accomplishments during his presidency, but most notably, dearest to my heart, is that he set us on a path of conservation of public lands. It's largely thanks to him that we have so many federal parks and federal public lands now. And Theodore Roosevelt was a frankly racist imperialist who, because of his racism, led the United States in dominating Puerto Rico and Cuba and the Philippines, killing many people there. He just thought that they were inferior and that it was the white man's burden to take over them and steer them straight. So what do we do with that? I mean, we're not going to give the parks back, right? Or say, never talk about how they were founded. It's just an uncomfortable fact. Same man, both of those attitudes. When I say multiplied out times all the Rowlings and all the Roosevelts out there, I mean every single one of us examined closely enough would be one of those people who we want to shun certain things about them. Sometimes I think, you know, how will people look at my, you know, dusty old sermons in a generation, and, you know, how will we have progressed? I imagine maybe they'll look at and say, wow, she kind of wanted to say that she was in favor of animal rights, but she had this really half-hearted kind of approach to it. I mean, she ate animals, for one thing. And how often did she get up there and preach about animal rights? Which we now know, here are us in, 2085, we now know are really fundamental and correct. But really, we don't have to go look into the future to imagine how, with any human progress, we will all be found wanting. I don't know about you, but I'm wanting right now. And if you don't want to take spiritual guidance from somebody who can be selfish and greedy and thoughtless and even cruel, I'm not your woman. So that's number one, that we'll deny ourselves things that are valuable because of where they came from. Number two, kind of the reverse, is that we will deny the truth of bad things that people have done because it's just so unbearable. That thought that we'll then have to toss out the good that they did as well. I see this happening. For example, Thomas Jefferson, is he tough? Especially, you know, he's kind of a Unitarian. We claim him as our own, name districts after him and churches, and that's kind of uncomfortable now. And again, the whole question of whether you should actually honor somebody in that way, that's another bar, and it's a great conversation to have. But just how do we even acknowledge the reality of his life? I remember I had a conversation not long ago with a Unitarian Universalist about another person, I think he's also a UU, who goes around speaking as Thomas Jefferson in worship. You know, he does a sermon and kind of gives his Thomas Jefferson's life. Neither of them seems willing to accept that he did the things that we now know he did. You know, the Hemings descendants said for a long time, we're descended from Thomas Jefferson. And the other known Jefferson descendant said, yeah, no, that's just a myth. Now that DNA testing has come along, we know it for a fact. We know that Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings had children, which is to say, in plain language, he committed rape over and over again. Whatever their relationship, he owned her. So, not exactly an equal relationship. And furthermore, they had many children, and they were his slaves. His own children. He enslaved his children, not to put too fine a point on it. I mean, I don't need to list all the laudable things that Thomas Jefferson did, right? That are still laudable. But I think we need to hold those side by side, not refuse to believe what we now know to be true, not to refuse to believe what people make a good claim on before the DNA evidence came along, because it's hurtful to them. It excluded them from their history, from our history, from the descendants named at Monticello and in other places wherever Thomas Jefferson's story is told. It denied who they are and what happened to their many times great-grandmother. And of course, it lies about our history. Here's another example, again, bringing it really close to home. We sing the works of Jason Shelton from time to time. He's a UU composer, was a minister of music and ordained and fellowshipped, officially recognized by the Unitarian Universalist Association as a UU minister. He wrote The Fire of Commitment and now Answering the Call of Love, among other wonderful works. Do we have to not use them anymore if we acknowledge that he has been removed from fellowship for persistent sexual harassment of more than one woman? We can debate how we should use it and whether. I obviously have opinions about that because I programmed his music just a few weeks ago. Whether we should introduce it with that caveat. But what we can't do, what we cannot, must not do, is deny the harm he caused out of some mythical idea that then we cannot appreciate or use his music. Can we sit with the discomfort? Somebody makes beautiful things, the same person causes harm. Sometimes really serious harm, not just the trivial, more or less trivial harm that everybody does. It's essential that we not deny either of these truths. And the third thing that I think is so important when it comes to this question is that if we won't hold these two facts together, then what we are really doing is denying our own wholeness. We're fleeing either into unwanted pride or unwanted shame. I spoke in the lead up to this service of saving our souls, and this is what I mean. Not that our souls are immortal, that's one of those questions on which Unitarian Universalists need not all agree, what you think the soul is, if there's any such thing at all. But here's what I mean. That who we are now and who we can become in the future. That's what I would call our souls. Right now, as we live in these bodies, in this lifetime, and the wholeness of that, the health of our souls, depends upon our being willing, well, in Carl Jung's words, to embrace our shadow, to recognize all of ourselves, everything about ourselves. It doesn't mean we like everything about ourselves. It doesn't mean we don't want to change. Of course we do. But you know, you can't change what you won't acknowledge exists. And we can't be whole if we are hiding, running from the truth of ourselves. We can't be in real relationship with other people. If you've ever tried to be in a close relationship with somebody who's deeply afraid of and ashamed of a part of their personality, you know what I mean. You love them, but it's really hard to have a deep, honest conversation with them. They're wounded in their soul. And we wound ourselves when we tell ourselves that we have to be all one thing or another. There's no angels or devils here. There's just us humans. Human merely beings, as E.E. Cummings said. And this is what we are, a mix. And again, I don't mean to say everybody's the same kind of mix. There's some really horrible people out there who maybe were also, you know, nice to kittens. And there's some really wonderful people who cheated on their spouses, once kicked a dog. They did something wrong, because we all have. And then there's lots of middling mortals in between, trying to be good or not, messing up more frequently or less. That Solzhenitsyn quote that we shared, that we heard at Centering Words time, I want to continue it. The sentence that comes after, when he says, you know, there aren't evil people out doing insidious deeds, and we could just seek out and destroy, and that'll solve the problem. He says, the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And then he says, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? I think that's what we're trying to do sometimes. And spiritual wholeness means not to destroy, but to acknowledge the whole of ourselves, to own the whole of ourselves, even those parts that we are still striving and will continue to strive to change. We can't change them if we can't bear even to look at them, and we can't change them if we fear that whatever we discover must be destroyed, because we know in our hearts it's all tangled up. The very drive that made Margaret Sanger persist and found Planned Parenthood and say we need to give everybody the right to control their reproduction. How could we possibly unentangle that from the drive that made her want to reduce the numbers of the poor or other undesirables? So universalism, I think, is the faith that we can acknowledge the whole of who we are and keep on changing. Keep on changing for the better. That we can all be saved, not in that sense of we won't be thrown into hell, but in the sense of acknowledging we create hell right here for ourselves and for other people. And by owning, honestly acknowledging all of who they and we are, we have some hope of making this world a little kinder, more of a heaven and less of a hell. I want to close with one thing. From our covenant of right relations, this phrase has been going in my head all the time as I think about these ideas. We embrace forgiveness, for it opens us to hope. And again, I don't want to get into the question of, do we forgive people like Sanger and Roosevelt and Jason Shelton and Ernst Haeckel, any more than I want to get into whether we should name schools after Paul Revere. You know, we don't have to forgive somebody, and we don't have to put their statue in the town hall, in the town square, just because we recognize that we're complex. But I think of a couple other ways to put it that are closely related. We embrace flawedness. I don't know if that's a word, but that's what I mean. Not that we embrace our flaws. We'd like them to go away. We try to make them go away, but we embrace the fact that we are flawed, for it opens us to hope. We embrace complexity, for it opens us to hope, because what hope is there if we have to be 100% one thing or the other? It's just a myth, and it leaves us without any hope at all. Without these things, acknowledging that we're flawed, acknowledging that we're complex, acknowledging that that applies to everyone who has ever lived on this earth, there is no hope for any of us, no hope of creating community with other flawed people or embracing the whole truth of who we are. But here's the good news. When we do acknowledge them, when we do acknowledge the tangled web that we are and in which we live, that opens us to hope. So may we do.